And we passed Proposition 71 to fulfill the promise of stem cell research and to make California a global leader in this important health care effort.
It's California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger announcing with some flourish the passage of Prop 71 in California on Election Day last week. One of the state propositions that passed with flying colors in that state that a lot of social and moral conservatives, a lot of Christians, are deeply concerned about. We're going to be talking about Prop 71 and its passage. How did, well, in the words of our guest in this first 15 minutes, how did the legislature and the backers of Prop 71 managed to talk California taxpayers out of $3 billion for embryonic stem cell research? We're going to talk about that here in the first 10 minutes of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Wesley Smith will be our guest in about 15 minutes. Drusha Mushman will be joining us. We'll talk about children in Christian worship. She's a mother of seven children, and she's written a series of articles on children and worship for her church's newsletter. We'll be talking about that with her for the remainder of the first hour. In the second hour, we'll hear from President Bush, his chief political advisor, Karl Rove, James Dobson, and Senator Arlen Specter, kind of running the gamut of the Sunday morning news shows and talking about the moral vote of last week, or what people are claiming were the vote that was primarily about moral values. We'll hear a little bit from Karl Rove as he backs off from that proposition on Meet the Press in the second hour of the program. Then in the third hour, Dr. Timothy Dost will be our guest. We'll talk with him for about 40 minutes about Martin Luther's father, confessor, and friend, Johann von Staupitz. That's the third hour of Issues Etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Wesley Smith is a regular guest. He's a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, author of several books, including his latest, A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World, and he's also written a column for the Weekly Standard titled Suckers for Science, How to Talk California Taxpayers Out of $3 billion. Wesley, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
First of all, tell us what exactly passed last week in Prop 71 in California.
Well, Proposition 71, although this was never brought out in the campaign, realized that there was only one side of this campaign that had much of a voice, and that was the pro side, because they had a $25 million or so budget, which meant they were on television. And those of us who opposed had a $400,000 budget, which meant we weren't on television. And in a state with 30 million people and a state that is like the sixth or seventh largest economy in the world, you cannot communicate with $400,000. You can communicate with $25 million. But what was not discussed was that this created a constitutional right to engage in human cloning research and embryonic stem cell research. Secondly, there was what was communicated, which is why we were still in the game up until the Arnold Schwarzenegger endorsement, was that this was going to cost the state $6 billion when you include interest. And this is a state that has its financial wheels falling off. We are dead broke. We are so broke that we are closing trauma centers and emergency hospital rooms. Our services are being cut for senior citizens and people with developmental disabilities. And indeed, there was a proposition on the ballot, which I write about in my Weekly Standard piece, Proposition 67, which would have added a modest tax to our phone bills to keep emergency rooms open. Californians refused that, even though it might mean the difference between living and dying today, to support a really hypothetical, morally controversial, and speculative program of research into human cloning and embryonic stem cell research that, if it ever produces cures, which is not a given, won't do so perhaps for a decade or more.
Now, you say blame the awesome power of big money, big celebrities, and big hype. First of all, let's talk about the second one. The governor of California is both a big celebrity and a big politician now in that state, the biggest there is. How decisive was Schwarzenegger's endorsement of 71 in its passage?
Well, we'll never know for sure, but I can say that in the field poll, which is the primary poll out here, prior to, I now call him the Bondinator, by the way, instead of the Terminator, prior to the Bondinator's endorsement, Proposition 71 was not over 50%. And that's a real problem for any initiative. In fact, the initiative had started out with only about a 44% approval. And usually in California to win an initiative fight, you have to start with the 60s. in the 60s because undecideds tend to vote no when they get to Election Day. But when Arnold, who made his, Governor Schwarzenegger, made his reputation as a fiscal conservative, nobody ever considered him anything but amoral when it comes to social issues, and he never hid that point. But fiscally, he was supposedly conservative. When he came out for this, I mean, it was the kiss of death for the no campaign, because one of the strongest arguments we had here in California, which is pretty socially liberal, was that, you know, whatever one might think of embryonic stem cell research or cloning or George Bush's federal funding policy, for us Californians, and remember, I live here, to go $6 billion in debt is fiscal folly. Indeed, we had some very interesting articles written by pro-embryonic stem cell research advocates, such as Alan Goodman, who's a nationally syndicated columnist, urging a no vote. Peter Schrag, who is perhaps the dean of California pundits, who is for embryonic stem cell research, vote, saying no. The Sacramento Bee urging a no vote. But boy, you sure couldn't beat the star quality of Arnold Schwarzenegger.
And I'm wondering, did this endorsement by the governor, being given the fact that he's recognized as a fiscal conservative, did it give a cover to otherwise social conservatives to vote for Prop 71, do you think? Since the governor was saying
this? I'll tell you, I don't know. The only poll I've seen on that issue is I do believe some social conservatives voted yes. But I think that what really happened was that the Catholic vote was overwhelmingly yes, which was a surprise to me. At the last field poll that was taken after the Arnold Schwarzenegger endorsement showed about a 54% win, and it ended up getting about 59 to 60. And in that poll, I was rather stunned to find that 63% of Catholics were going to vote yes. So since this violated every precept of Catholic moral teaching, either the people who were saying they were Catholics were just, you know, I suppose, historically Catholic. But if they were devout Catholics, they were violating what their church says is right on this issue.
It strikes me as odd, Wesley, you've pointed this out many times on the program, that what's really at stake here in Prop 71 was state funding, taxpayer funding, for this research. One must ask, why in the world can't the researchers get the anxious dollars of private investors for embryonic stem cell research? After all, if it has the promise of bringing about these cures, along with patents and all the other things that make money, I would think that the prudent investor would want to put their money in there.
Well, sure. If they were going to get what the promise is, there would be billions and billions to be made. However, in doing their due diligence, for the most part, private venture capitalists and investors have avoided human cloning companies and embryonic stem cell research companies quite effectively, which was why they now have gone to Plan B, which is to get the taxpayers to pay for it. Ironically, many of the people who funded Proposition 71 are investors, you know, are venture capitalists. Now that we're going to give private companies billions of dollars, you'll watch, these people will invest in those companies because they're going to get money back from the taxpayers.
Now, you also say that big hype was involved here. I'm wondering about the role of the media during the campaign for Prop 71.
Well, I think you have to go beyond the media for Prop 71. Prop 71 was discussed in the state, but not as thoroughly as these issues have been discussed for the last several years. Remember when Ronald Reagan died? There was this big, huge hue and cry from the biotech industry that if only he'd had embryonic stem cells, he might have been helped. Well, of course, as we've discussed on this show, and as reported by the Washington Post, and a notable exception to the usual mindset here, it's a fairy tale, and that's the words of a biotech researcher to believe that stem cells are going to help Alzheimer's disease, because it is a whole brain disease and not a cellular disease. Ron Reagan's very hyped speech at the Democratic Convention, which supposedly was about stem cell research but was actually about therapeutic cloning, even though he didn't use that term, was added to that. When Senator Edwards, John Edwards, said that if John Kerry is elected, people will get out of their wheelchairs and walk, I mean, that was kind of like the low point of the campaign in many regards. But the media have, for the last several years, been in a groupthink war against President Bush's policy on federal funding, which is a very minor limit on funding, by the way, And secondly, been hyping for several years now the idea that somehow embryonic stem cell research are going to provide the cures, while ignoring, as we've discussed many times on this show, the tremendous advances being made using adult stem cells, umbilical cord blood stem cells, and other adult tissues. Just one example, recently mice with late-stage juvenile diabetes were cured of their disease using spleen cells. And this was written up in the science journal Science, which is one of the most prestigious in the world and peer-reviewed. That is now ready for human trials, yet the Juvenile Research Diabetes Foundation, Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, refused to fund, as my understanding, that human trials, but put $1 million into Prop 71. I mean, some of that kind of thinking just it blows my mind.
Finally, I'd like your reaction to a op-ed piece that appeared in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, our local paper here, called California's New Gold Rush. It bemoans the fact that California will now be able, with 12 times the amount of money that the federal government is spending on embryonic stem cell research, be able to attract the best and the brightest. And it says, Missouri may have to build on its strength in less controversial areas of life and plant sciences, but by their nature, the best and the brightest scientists are drawn to the frontier, and they will seek opportunities in states and countries that share that progressive attitude. Your reaction to that?
Well, what is being advocated here, by the way, is anything goes. The underlying theme of all of these discussions is that there should be no limit, no fettering of unlimited naked science, and that the moral concerns and moral issues that many of us express should be disregarded, and that the only people who have a right to say what is right and moral in science are scientists. And I get into this quite a bit in my book, Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. Actually, I think Missouri is in better shape than California, because if we're going to put all this money into this narrow, arcane area of embryonic stem cells and cloning, which may not ever pan out, the places where you will have successes are more likely, let's put it this way, I shouldn't say will, are more likely to have successes are in the adult stem cell areas and other very non-controversial areas of biotech. Biotech is a huge field. Developing cancer drugs that are genetically targeted to patients is not controversial, has the great potential to offer great profit. And why should scientists move from Missouri, where they have a lower cost of doing business, and come to California to do that kind of research? You guys could actually now attract the areas of biotech that can actually offer more immediate potential for success and not throw your money down what may be a rat hole. So I think the newspaper editorial you just told me about has it just backwards.
And finally, you mentioned the term $6 billion several times here.
That's including interest.
So the $3 billion, along with interest over time, is going to add up to double that figure.
At least, but you know what? That's based on today's low interest rates. And realize also that California's bond rating is in the toilet, excuse me. So it wouldn't surprise me if it actually went above $6
billion. Wesley Smith is author of this column in the Weekly Standard titled Suckers for Science, and you can read it on the web at his website, WesleyJSmith.com, WesleyJSmith.com. Wesley will also be back with us this Sunday night on Issues Etc., our nationally syndicated program, to discuss the new book, A Consumer Guide, Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. That's Sunday night, this coming Sunday night on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis from 10 to 11. Wesley Smith, thank you very much for being our guest again.
Thanks, Todd. Talk to you soon.
Wesley, a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute and author of several books, including his latest, Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to spend some time talking about your kids on Sunday morning in the pew, children and worship. Now, my wife and I have children. We go to worship. Our children are getting older, and therefore the task, by and large, the task of managing the worship hour, that 1 hour or so where we sit in the pew together as a family, is becoming somewhat easier. I have to say less and less as we pull into the driveway of church. Best behavior. That's my mantra on Sunday morning. Best behavior. Now, I say that for a number of reasons, but partly I'd like to be able to pay attention on Sunday morning. How do we deal with our children on Sunday morning and not resort to the cop-out and the parental abomination called children's church. A lot of churches are offering that. But if you want your children's in the pew with you on Sunday morning, this next 40 minutes of Issues, Etc. is for you. Drisha Mushman is our guest. She's mother of seven children in Fort Wayne. I can only imagine what Sunday morning is like for Drisha and her husband. She's a member of Ascension Lutheran Church in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and author of a series of articles on children and worship for her church's newsletter. Drisha, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Well, good to be here.
First of all, let's just lay out the problem, and if you would, the major cause of the problem of little children, by and large, in church. How would you characterize it?
Well, I think a lot of times the children don't know what's expected of them, and they're not taught. You know, we just sort of often expect them just to know that they should be quiet and sit quietly. But, you know, if they're not kind of trained how to do that, often they can be distracting. And that causes embarrassment for the parents. It's distracting to other worshipers. Now, my children now are age 16 to 5, but we have always kept them in church with us. We did not use the nursery, mostly because that's the way my husband and I were raised. Our parents always brought us in, and if you got taken out, it was not a happy time.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of learned, and we wanted that for our children. I know that when I was in college, I benefited a lot from just feeling like Sundays, you go to church. You know, when you're out on your own, sometimes you're making your own decisions. Those habits can be very helpful in continuing your spiritual growth when maybe you might go astray. So we just started out with our oldest child, keeping him in church. Now, I do have to say, too, that the church we attended at that time was not real strict on child behavior. You know, some churches, it's quiet as can be. You can hear a pin drop and do a Sprint commercial
mm-hmm.
in them. That's a little more difficult to start out with the real young ones. But even at Ascension, which tends to be on the quieter side, when our daughter Christina, who's the youngest, was born, I brought her right into church, and she just learned how to be quiet. One of the things I learned from my mother is never say shh. For one thing, it carries like crazy, and for another thing, the kids really love to say shh back at you, and you're in what I call a shh war.
And that can become distracting. Carl Schalk, who's a guest on this program, wrote a little book where he talked about children and church and children and music. And one of the things that he says is maybe one of the sources of the problem is that we tend to reserve the back four rows of the church for parents with small children. Now, there are good reasons to do that. Proximity to the door
exactly.
and the bathroom is one. But he says putting the children in the back row is about the worst place to put a kid when you're trying to teach them that what's happening in church is significant and not only requires, but also they benefit from paying attention.
Well, I couldn't agree with that more. We usually try to sit either in the front row or towards the front, because then the kids can see what's going on. And so it's a lot more interesting and easier for them to be quiet.
So what are we aiming at? I mentioned in my open, you know, my mantra on Sunday morning had for so many years just been, as we pull into the driveway of the church, best behavior. Are we just looking for our kids to behave well in church?
Well, I guess what I looked for, my husband and I sort of, we had a lot of common assumptions when we started this, because we were both raised in Lutheran churches and we were familiar with how it goes, and my husband is an organist. So what we look for is, one, that the kids would participate in as much as they can. So once they get about 3 years old, we would start wanting them to sit. We'd hold a hand and kind of raise them up when the congregation stood, sit them down. And we also would sing some of the liturgy at home as bedtime songs so that they would get real familiar and they would be able to sing. And we didn't even, you know, if our baby was going, la, 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 and, you know, some of the sort of baby singing while the whole congregation is singing, that was fine with us. They were participating at their level. So we're looking for some participation so that they're interested, but we're also looking for that they're not distracting other worshipers.
So there's a whole complex of things here that the children would realize at their level what it is that's taking place in Christian worship. God comes to us and brings to us Jesus Christ through the preaching of the word and the administration of the sacraments, but also that they simply behave in a civil way with all the other people around them.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, if they go, one of the things that I absolutely found that if you want to keep your kids on best behavior is don't let them get away with a thing in church. You know, if you don't allow pinching your sibling at home and, you know, Poindexter gives Agatha a little pinch and you notice it, but there's no big fuss, take them out and get them straightened out. Otherwise, what they learn is, oh, you know, church, the rules don't quite apply, so this is a good place to break the rules. And you don't want them learning that. You want them to know that, like you're saying, best behavior and what that exactly means. Because best behavior can also mean interacting with people, and sometimes other worshipers can be frustrating. Your child is sitting quietly, and the person behind them or in front of them turns around and makes faces at them or hands them a toy or something, which isn't helping your child to maintain that level of behavior. So,
when we come back from this break, we're going to continue our conversation with Drusha Mushman talking about children and worship. I cannot help but remember two incidents, folks, from early on. She talked about teaching our children to sing significant parts of the liturgy at home. Now, my wife and I think we might have tried this once or twice, but our youngest, our son, before he could actually put sentences together, was often found in his crib, either at nap time or bedtime, singing parts of the liturgy. He just picked it up. He was a sponge for the music. He didn't know what the words meant. He was just mimicking what he heard every Sunday in worship. You see, our children really are tuned in far more than we think they are. If we think that it's all completely irrelevant to them. Now, the other thing I remember, and I want to talk to Drusha about this when we come back, is very recently sitting in church, looking a few pews ahead. This was an evening service, and seeing an 8-10-year-old boy there playing with his Game Boy. Now, he was quiet. He wasn't bothering anyone around him. The volume was turned down, so you couldn't hear what was going on. The only time you really noticed the Game Boy was there was when they dimmed the lights at the end of the service, and the light from the Game Boy was shining all around. But someone might say, look, at least it keeps them well-behaved. Is that the solution? We'll answer that question with Drusha Mushman when we come back and continue our conversation through the end of this hour on children and worship. Then, in the second hour of the program, we've got a lot to get through. We're going to be hearing from President Bush, from Karl Rove, from James Dobson, and from Senator Arlen Specter. All of them were making statements back and forth and explaining the election, the expectations after the election. On the Sunday morning programs, we'll be walking through a lot of that audio. There's also an interesting transcript from Meet the Press. Karl Rove was there Sunday morning with Tim Russert, and the question centered around Roe v. Wade. Three very pointed questions were put to Rove, and I was very interested in his answers. We'll talk about that in the second hour. Stay with us.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The basic challenges of raising small children may be simple, but that doesn't mean they're easy. In the Christian home, how do we teach our small children about sin and about their Savior Jesus Christ? How do we guide them in their daily life as a baptized child of God, the life of daily repentance and the forgiveness of sins in Christ? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for November is called Faithfully Parenting Preschoolers. Or, if your children are older, we're offering Faithfully Parenting Teens. You can order either of these books for $9.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, Faithfully Parenting Preschoolers or Faithfully Parenting Teens.
This Global Minute highlights the need to lift up the people in Nepal in prayer. After a year and a half of language training, Holly is using her medical skills as a doctor for the glory of God in a country with great spiritual needs. Travel can be dangerous in Nepal with monsoon-caused landslides and travel trouble due to the Maoist group, which was officially labeled by the U.S. as a terrorist group. Holly and another doctor, Melissa, are the only foreigners working at a short-staffed hospital in Nepal. The patient-doctor ratio is 90,000 to 1. Two Nepali doctors who need prayer for their salvation have recently come to help. The hospital currently is not a terrorist target. The Maoists need medical care too. But pray for the protection of God's workers, Holly and Melissa, striving to let His light shine through them at a remote hospital in Nepal. And pray for their strength and opportunities to share the gospel. Ready to climb out of your comfort zone? Explore the website missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Have the fall leaves been colorful where you live? In our backyard, we have what botanists call a Euonymus elatus compactus. For us commoners, that's a burning bush. True to its name, its leaves turn a brilliant red in fall. The popular name comes from Exodus chapter 3. The angel of the Lord appeared to Moses in flames of fire from within a bush, and God said, "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground." A bush. And so much else we speed by every day. Wherever you look, nature offers countless opportunities to stand in awe at the magnificence of God's creation. Elizabeth Barrett Browning wrote, "Earth is crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God, and only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit around and pluck blackberries." If you've only been plucking away at your schedule, you still have many opportunities for holy, marveling moments. Take a look, for example, at old Euonymus elatus compactus when it is bare. You will see that its branches are square, not round. So many opportunities to marvel. But what do we do? Rush on to the next meeting, watch the next show, or pluck at our blackberries.
Do you want more of God's grace? Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights is a Bible-believing church, faithful to the Scriptures, a place for the whole family, a community gathered around Christ that cares with a vibrant historic Christian liturgy. Bethany Lutheran Church is located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. Visit them at www.bethanylcms.org. We're talking for the remainder of this first hour about children and worship. We've got a great resource for you, by the way. Whether you're the parent of preschoolers or of adolescents, teenagers, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for November. It's actually two books you can choose between one of the two. Faithfully Parenting Teens, Faithfully Parenting Preschoolers. These books are $9.99 plus shipping and handling apiece. And in the next 90 minutes, you can call Concordia Publishing House and order either of these two books, Faithfully Parenting Teens or Faithfully Parenting Preschoolers. Concordia Publishing House, their number 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or if you would like to order online or find out more information in advance of ordering, just go to our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section and you'll find the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, Faithfully Parenting Teens. Or if your kids are a little younger, Faithfully Parenting Preschoolers. If you're out and about and you'd like to pick it up at one of the two locations where Concordia Publishing House operates bookstores in the St. Louis area, you can either go to 3558 South Jefferson or here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton, 801 Seminary Way here in Clayton. Now, when you go in, say, "I listen to Issues, Etc. I'd like the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for November, Faithfully Parenting Teens, Faithfully Parenting Preschoolers. Just mention Issues, Etc." Dresha Mushman is our guest. She's mother of seven children in Fort Wayne. She's a member of Ascension Lutheran Church there, and she's also author of a series of articles on children and worship for her church's newsletter. Dresha, let's talk about a couple of the simple solutions that people might try. The first one I mentioned in our open, and that is children's church or the full-time nursery. Why are these not viable regular options for parents with children who go to church on Sunday morning?
Well, I think for some parents, I mean, I've heard arguments both ways. Some people have said, you know, by the end of the week, I need to be able to concentrate in church, and I can't concentrate with a two-year-old. The thing is that your child needs to be with you. If it's been hectic for you, it's been hectic for that child, too. And church can be a time where the child gets to sit on your lap and while you're listening to the sermon, and they learn to do some adult things, which I think really is a building block of self-esteem. It's not this I'm a good person kind of stuff. It's kind of saying, look, I can behave well, and I can do this just like an adult. And I think that that's a much better self-esteem builder for the child. And I think that it builds solidity in the family. It builds a good habit for the child. And we often discuss the sermon after the church service, either on the way home or at lunch. And, you know, if I have a five-year-old, I'll say, you know, did Pastor tell a funny story today? Or what Bible verse did you hear? Something direct and concrete that keeps the child listening so they can have the thrill of saying, oh, yeah, I remember this.
Now, Drusha, I know you're not an enemy of the so-called toy bag. I got two questions with regard to that. First of all, your reaction to the little anecdote I told about seeing the kid playing Game Boy during, I think it was a Lenten Wednesday night service, through the entire thing. He didn't make a peep, and you couldn't hear the Game Boy, but he sat there playing with it. Is that going over the line for the so-called toy bag for kids?
Well, it does. I would say there are two things that I would say strike up a problem, why I would not do that. And one is, at 10, I think the child should be able to participate throughout the sermon or throughout the service, either singing and rising with the congregation. The other thing is, I've played Game Boy. It's really riveting. You're not paying attention to what's going on around you. You're riveted by that little machine. So what's the benefit of being in church there when you're not listening to what's being said or singing, and so you're not being spiritually fed because you're really off in your own world with that Game Boy? We did use a toy bag, but one of my rules for when I'm thinking what to put in that toy bag is it needed to be quiet, which was considerate that he had the Game Boy quiet. The toys needed to be quiet, but they also needed to be such that the kid wasn't going to be totally involved with a brand new toy and just be so into the toy that they're not paying attention to what's going on around them. You want something that's interesting, but not too interesting.
My youngest does a lot of drawing during church. He's got a little clipboard. They even give out clipboards at the church we attend with pencils for the kids to doodle and draw during the course of the service. What do you think?
I think that that can be appropriate, especially if you can kind of, I don't know, this may be stretching it, but this is what I would mention to my kids sometimes, is to draw a picture, say, of the gospel lesson. If it's Jesus and the 10 lepers, let the child draw a picture of Jesus or the leper or something like that. So it's sort of the child's reaction to what they're hearing, what they're learning. But, you know, it depends on the age of your child. It depends on what you can expect out of them. But in general, I think drawing is, you know, it's quiet. It's not that engrossing, and it can be an interaction with the service, too, at that child's level.
Let's talk some nuts and bolts. The biggest one that usually comes up is the issue of having to go to the bathroom. What's a good policy?
Well, we make sure the kids go to the bathroom. Now, I will differentiate between someone who's two and just potty trained. I would make sure that child went to the bathroom, like right before church. They go to the bathroom, you walk in. And then, you know, I know that when we're at home, they don't go to the bathroom every hour. They can go 2-3 hours. And so we really did not allow potty breaks, period. And certainly once they were 4 or 5, we just didn't do it. Because I figure if they can go through a morning without going to the bathroom, they can go for an hour And we made sure they went to the bathroom right before church.
I mean, that's our first stop. The kids just know that. You walk into the narthex, and both the kids head for the bathroom.
Sure. And that's just sensible, because it is distracting when people get up and leave. I suppose if the kid looked like they were going to throw up or something, I would move them out. But in general, we have not done that. They just knew if someone whispered to me, well, I have to go to the bathroom, I would say it's not long till the end of the service.
What about talking?
Okay, yeah. Talking for asking, like, which hymn are we on, or where are we, or I'm lost, or, you know, that kind of thing. Whispering, you know, very, you know, quiet voice. That would be allowed. But in terms of chit-chatting back and forth, oh, Mom, look, there's Susie. Nope, that's not going to, that dog won't hunt. We're not. And then my husband and I try to do the same thing. Sometimes you'll even see adults talking back and forth during a quiet time in the church. And so we just try not to do that. It's distracting.
Posture, you mentioned this in the course of one of your articles on children and worship. Why is this important?
Well, I think that if a child, I've seen 10-year-olds or even, you know, my older children have tried, they're tired, and so they'll try and sort of lay on my lap or lay on the pew. Well, one issue for us is with nine of us in a pew, there's not that much room. But the other thing is, I think it's hard to be attentive when you're sort of sprawled out. I think parents 100 years ago understood better the effect of posture on your mental frame of mind than we tend to today. We tend to be very casual. So if the child is a 2-year-old, I might let lay down on the pew. But older children, no, they should sit up and keep their eyes forward. And we try to train even the little ones to keep their eyes forward. That's how we do it in this church. Now, other churches may have, you know, different standards of behavior where looking around is more allowed. But in our particular church, it's just not, that's distracting as judging from the general behavior of everybody else. So we encourage the kids to sit up and to be looking forward up towards the altar and the pulpit.
There were times when our teenager was much younger when I wondered whether or not they were piping gas or something into the church, or whether or not somehow her spine became less solid when the prelude began to play, because it seems as though they became overcome, kind of the way I am when I go shopping with my wife and we go into one of the ladies' stores and I suddenly lose the will to stand any longer.
Mm-hmm.
And I become kind of like a sloth in many ways. And I noticed our kids do this as well. Is there something you could do beforehand? To say to your kids, now look, I know you're going to have the temptation to just kind of flop over as though we just pumped you full of narcotics, but you can sit up, you can pay attention.
Right, and I think, you know, older kids, you've got to watch. It can be a little demeaning to do this, but with younger kids, you can say, well, let's play church. Okay, now we're going to sit down. Maybe you can watch something like the McNeil Lehrer Report or some other sort of talking head program and say, now let's see if we can sit properly here on the couch. Let's sit right for 5 minutes. I bet you can do it for 5 minutes. And if they make the 5 minutes, give them some sort of treat or something. And so you're teaching them at home, so it's not an unfamiliar behavior when you get to church. I mean, that sounds silly, but if you train them and teach them, then they know what's expected, and they know that they can do it. It doesn't seem too hard. And sometimes, you know, if we were having a particular problem with somebody slouching or talking during church, I might say before we go into church, 5 M&Ms if you can sit up straight through the whole service. You know, and then everybody who does it gets the 5 M&Ms. I would not say the quietest one in church gets a treat and the other ones don't, because otherwise then you have siblings who are going, gee, he's going to win. I'm going to distract him so he doesn't.
Yeah, you sound like the mother of 7 children.
Yeah.
Joshua Mushman is our guest. We're talking about children and worship. Now, parents will find themselves between a rock and a hard place because there they are in church. They've got people all around them, a whole 5, 6, 7 rows of people behind them as well. They're very self-conscious that their children are distracting others. And yet, at the same time, many parents find themselves reluctant to take the kid out or to acknowledge that the kid's misbehaving because they're afraid it will draw attention to the fact that their child's misbehaving, and they're afraid of what people will think.
And you know what people are probably thinking is, boy, I remember when my kids used to do that. One of the things at Ascension that I appreciated was somebody told me the story of the man who was our church president. His son cut up, and he dragged that kid out by his ear right up the center row, and it was a story in the church in terms of, yep, that's how you do it. If you let it go on longer, it will keep on going on. If you step on it, you'll have the momentary embarrassment of taking that child out, but that child will learn, I'm not doing that again. And another mistake I see a lot is parents will sit down outside and put the kid in their lap, and it'll be more fun for that child to be outside than to be in the service. My feeling is if you're going to take them out, it should be less pleasant. I have a friend, what she would do with her younger ones is she would take them out to the car. She had her Bible out in the car. She would put the child in the car seat, and he would sit there with absolutely nothing to do or watch except mom reading her Bible for 5 minutes. And then when the child had quieted down and she was ready to try it again, bring them back in.
Folks, so, if you have a question or a comment on, or in fact a personal story to tell about children in worship, give us a call, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dresha Mushman is our guest in about 15 minutes. Open lines for your questions and your comments. We'll be hearing a lot of audio in the second hour. Karl Rove, the president himself, will also hear from James Dobson talking about Arlen Specter, and Arlen Specter talking about his hopes for the second Bush administration. All that in the second hour during open lines for your questions and your comments. Dresha, let's talk about the pre-service preparation, the basic things that can be done at home and then on the way to church that will help avoid some of the more obvious problems that are presented when we take our kids to church.
Yeah, I think you want your kids sort of emotionally and physically full. That means don't stay up late Saturday night, because if they're tired, they're not going to have the ability to control their behavior as well as they need to. What we instituted, too, was we always have some sort of like banana bread or squash bread, something that's easy to eat for breakfast and relatively clean, and that's pretty attractive, so the kids' stomachs are full. And then on the way to church, we may play a cassette of music, or we could sing songs from the liturgy, helping the kids learn that. Sometimes we would pray for pastor who's preaching that day that, you know, he would be able to preach the word clearly. The other thing is, too, because it's not always sweetness and light on Sunday morning. here I'm going to sound like a mother of seven as well. You know, shoes get lost. Kids decide to wrangle when you're trying to get out the door as quickly as you can. Sometimes I get short-tempered, and I yell at people I shouldn't yell at. I will also use that time in the car to ask forgiveness for where I've been unfair or sort of built up a resistant, rebellious attitude in my children. Some people might say, well, that undermines your authority, but that is the only way that I have ever seen that I can maintain the standard which I don't meet. You know, we say, yeah, you shouldn't call people names or whatever, but sometimes in the heat of the moment, I do that. Then I need to come to my children and say, that was wrong, and I'm asking you to forgive me. If you can repair that damage sort of interrelationship, I think it helps your kids not to feel resistant towards you in church, and it's biblical. Jesus said that if we thought of a sin that our brother had against us, we should go deal with that before bringing our offering to the altar. And I think this is just a very nuts and bolts way of dealing with that. I also think if we aim to leave earlier than we really need to, then that also avoids some of the rush to get into church. And so we're not doing the dragging people as we walk at our adult quick pace, and our three-year-old is walking at his probably not very quick pace.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Larry is calling from his car. Larry, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for taking my call. You may have covered this already. I just tuned in. But I know we had five, and when our children were younger, crying in church was often an issue, but we would take the child out of the service, do whatever needed to be done, whether it was discipline or whatever it was that needed to be done that stopped the crying. Maybe there was a problem. But then we would take them directly back in because we didn't want them getting the idea that crying or misbehaving was a way to get out of church. Would you just kind of comment on that?
I think that is right on. I do. I mean, yes, you need to deal with it because you need to take into account other worshipers and sort of whisking the child out quickly before they really crank up. Because we all know they start out, but if they see that they're not getting what they want out of it, they can really make a rip-roaring scene. So to sort of pull them out there and deal with the issue and then move them back in, I think is a great idea.
And they can, in their own way, exercise a little blackmail with the parents at a time like this. It becomes the push and shove that you find in all of the parent-child relationship, but it's intensified on Sunday morning in the pew, I think.
Yeah, I think one of the keys is as a parent, you need to care more about your child's behavior than what everybody else in the congregation, what you think they're thinking. I think that one thing that a congregation can do to help a parent with a child that's struggling to learn so many things is to be encouraging. When the child is doing better, come up and say, "You did a good job in church today." You know, and if I have seen this happen too. You know, if a mother or a father is having a struggle with the child, a lot of times people will sort of smile at the child trying to encourage him. Really, you need to smile at the parent and encourage him and sort of give the child a little bit of the cold shoulder so they sort of feel a little social pressure.
Back to the phones. Carla is calling from St. Louis. Carla, welcome.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. When we were younger, there was three of us girls, and we were probably first grade through fourth or fifth grade, and my father, very creative disciplinarian, and he just would take only so much, and he told us to quit. And so when we got home from church that day, he said, "Okay, you enjoyed flipping through the hymnal so much and kicking your feet. You can sit on the piano bench, and you can sit on the couch, and you can do that for 30 minutes since it was so much fun." So by the time the next week came around, we start doing whatever we're doing in church, and all he had to say was, "Do you want to do it again at home?" And that would stop us right in our tracks.
Yeah.
Carla, thank you.
More of the same. That is creative. What a great idea.
And so it points out something that sometimes the things that kids do during church to, quote-unquote, amuse themselves are not amusing in any other circumstances.
Right.
I mean, they find them drudgery in any other circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned this in an oblique way before, but I'd like you to flesh it out a little bit in the last few minutes here, and that is the tone that is set by the parents. There are some circumstances, some churches, where things are so very free and easy. You know, the parents come in with their big gulp from 7-Up, they're wearing their flip-flops and their cutoffs and their baseball caps, and everybody, not just the kids,
right,
are jabbering and during not only quiet times of the worship service, if there are any, but during the more active times as well. Can we expect kids to behave under such circumstances?
I think so, because I know this is really not what you hear on TV and everything, but baseline, your kids do want to be like you. You know, and if you can kind of mention, "You know, I know that people do it this way, but we're going to do it this way, and this is why." A lot of the times the kids rise to that standard of behavior. And if, you know, as you talk to them about it, and I'm talking about children 8, 9, 10, as you say, "You know what, it was really distracting that the people behind us kept whispering during the sermon. So we're not going to do that. And that's the rule for our family because we don't want to distract other people. We want them to hear what's going on. A lot of times the kids respond positively to that. They want to be like adults. You know, the culture's sort of shoving them the other way, but we don't have to go with that. We better not, because otherwise, you know, they'll end up by drinking too deeply of the culture, as a friend of mine is fond of saying.
Tricia, a word to the parishioners and the church members sitting there on Sunday morning who don't have kids, and they find themselves distracted by your kids or my kids. What would you say to them?
Well, I guess one thing is, I guess they need to realize the importance of the children learning to be in church, and that that is going to be a process, and it's not going to be that the child suddenly, you know, is not at all distracting, and maybe instead of the back being for the people with kids, maybe the back should be more for people without kids or people who don't have children could move to a different section. But I think there needs to be some Christian forbearance for noises that children are going to make in the interest of that child learning to be at a worship service and receive the benefit that God has for them.
You mentioned early on that both you and your husband were raised in families where going to church on Sunday morning was simply what the family did.
Right.
It wasn't an if, it was a when. Mm-hmm. Which service are we going to, not whether or not we're going to the service. I was raised in the same kind of family, and I often either privately or mentioned to others the benefit of that mindset that Sunday morning was the Lord's Day, and that Sunday morning was the time for the whole family to go to church. What are the adult benefits of our children learning that now with us as their parents?
Oh, I think the benefits are very great. I know that when I was in college, you know, you're out from under, you can choose your own habits. It felt so weird if I would think of not going to church, even if sometimes I was a little uncomfortable because I was making some choices during the week that I knew weren't so great. That benefit of knowing that that's where I needed to be, I needed to hear God's word, I just think that that is a lifetime thing. And I think also looking back, and I mentioned this in my article, my parents, when we were little...
With only about 10 seconds here, sorry.
Okay. When we were little, my dad would follow along in the hymn book. I can still see his finger doing that. That's a priceless memory for me.
Drescher,
and it's centered around Christ.
Oh, Drescher, thank you very much for being our guest.
Okay, thank you.
Drescher Mushman, mother of seven children, talking about children and worship. When we come back, open lines for your questions and your comments.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.